Welcome to History Counts. The purpose of this series is to bring to you the true facts of history. History provides the roadmap for the future, and the future belongs to the people. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. On December 7, 1941, the Japanese launched a devastating attack on the United States military forces at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. The next day, President Franklin D. Roosevelt asked Congress to approve a declaration that a state of war existed with Japan. In his address to Congress, the president called the Japanese attack an unprovoked surprise. Congress promptly approved the president's call to war with only one dissenting vote. But was the attack on Pearl Harbor in fact a surprise? And did the United States intentionally provoke the attack? During the next half hour, you will hear these important questions answered by our very special guest, author Robert Stinnett. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm pleased to have as my guest today Robert Stinnett, the author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor, published by Free Press. Mr. Stinnett served in the U.S. Navy during World War II, earning 10 battle stars and a presidential unit citation. He's worked as a journalist and a photographer for the Oakland Tribune, and he's a consultant on the Pacific War for the BBC and the Asahi and NHK television in Japan. He's currently a research fellow at the Independent Institute, a nonprofit public policy research organization located in Oakland, California. Mr. Stinnett, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
In your book, you address two crucial questions about Pearl Harbor. Did the U.S. deliberately provoke the Japanese attack on December 7, 1941? And secondly, did high-ranking U.S. government officials, including President Franklin D. Roosevelt, have advanced knowledge of the attack and withheld this information from the U.S. military commanders at Pearl Harbor? Now, with respect to the first question, whether the U.S. deliberately provoked the attack, you discovered in your research a memo written over a year before the attack on Pearl Harbor, which some would call a smoking gun. Could you talk about that memo?
Yes, on October 7th, 1940, that was a year before the Pearl Harbor attack, a Navy officer in the Office of Naval Intelligence drew up a plan to entice Japan to attack the Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. And he came up with eight actions that he said would cause Japan to commit an overt act of war against the United States.
What was his name?
His name is Lieutenant Commander Arthur McCollum.
And who did his memorandum go to?
And this was directed to the Director of Naval Intelligence, Admiral Walter Anderson.
And what were the points that he was making?
He was he made several points. It's about a five-page memorandum. And in the beginning, he points out that Hitler had captured most of Europe, was bombing England daily, and there was massing invasion troops on the French coast, and predicted that there was planning to seize the British fleet and then merge it with the Nazi Navy and then come over here to the Western Hemisphere and go for Canada and British possessions in the Atlantic coast off the United States, Bermuda and so forth, and British possessions in the Caribbean.
And although the United States at that point was not in the war, and President Roosevelt was running on a campaign to keep us out of World War II, the president, in fact, really wanted to get into the war.
Well, that's right. Most Americans realized the danger of Hitler, but they did not. They didn't want to get into the war. They had had it in World War One. The Europeans didn't pay the bills, and the American mothers were marching on Washington, D.C. All of the polls showed 80% of Americans wanted nothing to do with Europe's war. That's what they called it.
Now, just before he drafted this memorandum, Lieutenant Commander McCollum did, there was a treaty signed between Germany and Italy and Japan that affected it.
Yes, the three nations, the three Axis nations, however they were called, signed the tripartite treaty. And that was a permanent commission that was established in Berlin. And they met there all throughout the war, right up until German surrender in May 1945. So they made the plans for how they would conduct the war, and said in the treaty that if they got into a war with an unnamed nation, being the United States, they called it, if we got into a state of war, then they would come to one another's defense.
So McCollum recognized that if we went to war with Japan, we'd soon thereafter be at war with Germany as well.
That was the absolute plan of McCollum.
What were some of the 8 steps that he suggested to be taken in order to confront the Japanese?
Among them was a complete oil embargo against Japan, and get the Dutch nation, who had oil reserves in the Southeast Asia, Britain and the United States, to cut off all oil reserves. But also to send American cruisers into Japanese territory to really tick off the nationalist spirit in Japan. And then also the main deal was to keep they call it then the United States fleet, based at Hawaii. Normally it was based on the Pacific coast and also on the Atlantic coast. But most of the battleships were stationed at Pearl Harbor.
I'm reading from the conclusion of the memo, as it appears in your book. Quote, McCollum says, quote, "If this means Japan could be led to commit an overt act of war, so much the better," end quote.
That's what he wrote, and that's what the policy that President Roosevelt adopted the very next day, on October 8th, when he called the fleet commander from Hawaii to the Oval Office and told him about this plan. And the admiral just blew up at the president, said that naval officers don't have any confidence in your leadership. Well, you don't talk that way to President Roosevelt.
Now, President Roosevelt himself had been Assistant Secretary of Navy, so he would have followed these matters closely.
Oh, that's right. He was he loved the Navy and understood naval tactics. He was a sailor himself.
Now, the Admiral James Richardson, who was in command of the Pacific Navy, he would have had to have been on alert before October the 7th, I would assume, in order to have been in Washington October the 8th to meet with the president.
Oh, yeah. So he got those orders sometime right after the tripartite pact was signed on September 27th, 1940.
So although President Roosevelt's name doesn't appear on the McCollum memo, it can be inferred that he knew its contents?
Every one of those 8 actions was adopted by the president, some of them by executive order. The oil embargo and cutting off all supplies signed in July 1941 by executive order. All the rest were done by naval orders.
And it is also, I can see from your book, endorsed in writing by his naval advisor, Dudley Knox.
Yes, he was the librarian for the Office of Naval Intelligence, and he, as you said, he signed off on it.
So let's look at the second part of this examination. Did the U.S. have foreknowledge of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor? Could you tell us something about the radio monitoring capabilities of the United States, as well as far as intercepting messages and also as far as radio direction finders, as existed before Pearl Harbor?
Yes, well, the U.S. Navy had 25 monitor stations in the Pacific Basin. That would be on the included the from Panama up to West Coast to Alaska, and then with British stations on China and Southeast Asia. And then in the Philippines, we had more monitor stations, and also at Midway Island, at Samoa, and Hawaii. And there were 2 processing stations that translated and broke the Japanese codes. One was at Corregidor, and the other was at Hawaii.
Corregidor is in the Philippines?
In the Philippines, yes.
Now, prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor, did the U.S. Navy break the Japanese naval code? It's referred to as a 5-num code, or also as referred to as Code Book D?
Yes, the Japanese called their operation code Code Book D, and it was a 5-number code that represented Japanese words and military terms. And the United States called it the five-number code because of the five numbers. And we had broken it, but the Japanese would change it about every 6 months. And when that was done, it took about 3 months to break into the new code. So November 1941, they were in the seventh version of this code.
And there was an expert, the Lieutenant John Lightweiler that you referred to. He was who had a great expertise in this code, a corregidor.
Yes, he had been trained to break the code book D, and was in charge of the station at Corregidor. And he broke the code on November 16th, 1941. It's Manila time.
The Japanese fleet commanders, as they approached to attack in the 2 weeks or so before December 7th, did they break radio silence and reveal their locations?
Yes, the Japanese forces that were aimed at American territory in the Central Pacific, that means Hawaii and Wake and Guam Islands, broke radio silence on the day that they left Japan to proceed to American territory. And the commander of the Japanese carrier force was in extensive communications. That's the word of the code-breaking unit in Hawaii, with the commander of the submarine force and also the invasion forces. And that continued for about a week. And these messages were also heard at the 12th Naval District listening post in California.
There was an important message on November 25th, 1941, from the Japan's Admiral Yamamoto.
Yamamoto, who was the commander-in-chief, the operating chief of the Japanese fleet, directed that beginning that day, all warships would remain on radio silence. But he had a proviso. That was up to each commander, that if the commander wanted to break radio silence, they could. And this is what happened. And our radio direction finders on these 25 stations from the West Coast to Alaska and in the Philippines and in Samoa, they all heard these broadcasts.
Yeah, you mentioned specifically in your book that, quote, seven Japanese naval broadcasts intercepted between November 28 and December 6 confirmed that Japan intended to start the war and that it would begin in Pearl Harbor.
Yes, that was the observation from the Navy intercept operators.
So they knew, again, they knew the content after these were decoded, but they would know immediately where the ships were.
Yes, because the radio direction finders, you see, would pinpoint the location in the North Pacific and then the submarine force in the Central Pacific that was proceeding eastward to Hawaii.
Now, there was also the matter of a Japanese spy who was in the Honolulu consulate. And could you talk about him and what we learned from him?
Yes, in March 1941, Admiral Yamamoto dispatched a Japanese naval ensign to Hawaii, to pretend he was a part of the consulate, and he took over the consulate position as chancellor. But he was not listed in the Foreign Office Ministry, so that alerted the naval intelligence. Hey, something's not right here. So they started monitoring him, and the FBI had a tail on him. And he was, at first, he was starting to prepare a census of the U.S. fleet that was in Hawaii and would send that information back to Tokyo by RCA Communications and also another communications outfit called McKay that alternated in the Japanese message units that were being sent from Honolulu to Tokyo.
So he was essentially sending targeting information for Pearl Harbor?
Yes. First, he started sending the census of the names of the warships and how they operated in Hawaii. And then beginning in August 1941, he started preparing bomb plots of Ford Island. and where the warships, the battleships, the cruisers, where they anchored, and gave them a designated figure, like XY would be Ford Island, and so forth. And this was sent by RCA Communications to Tokyo, and we also we intercepted these messages, translated them, and the messages went to President Roosevelt.
So, in fact, you mentioned that President Roosevelt met with David Sarnoff regarding the interception of messages?
Yes. Right after the spy was started to, when he presented these bomb plot messages, he wanted to be, President Roosevelt wanted to be sure that we got all of the messages. So he met with David Sarnoff, who was head of RCA Communications and also the National Broadcasting Company. So Sarnoff went to Hawaii, met with the agent in charge of RCA there in Honolulu and told him to give the messages to the Naval Intelligence in Honolulu with the idea that it would go to the American military commanders at Honolulu, but they didn't.
So this is the key. These messages were going to Washington, to high-ranking officials, including President Roosevelt. And Roosevelt, you mentioned, had a Kopeck decoder on his yacht?
Yes. All of the intelligence gathered by the monitor stations was sent by a special code machine called Kopeck. And President Roosevelt had that machine aboard his yacht, the Potomac. So when he was aboard the ship, he was kept abreast of the very latest information from the Japanese sources.
So he was receiving information not only from the intercepts of naval communications, but also these intercepts coming out of the Japanese consulate in Honolulu.
Yes, well, the messages from the consulate and from the warships were put onto the Kopeck system, so they could reach the president. You know, that was all encoded also.
So he was getting the information, but were the commanders in Hawaii, Admiral Husband Kimmel and Lieutenant General Walter Short, were they getting the information?
It was the information was being sent by from the station in Corregidor to them, but there was this Admiral Anderson who got the original McCullough memo, was the gatekeeper there and kept that information from Admiral Kimmel and General Short, the Hawaiian commanders.
He was the Office of Naval Intelligence Chief.
Yeah, he was. But Roosevelt appointed him to the number three post of the Pacific Fleet, and he was made commander of the battleships. He was in charge of all nine battleships.
You mentioned that at one point, Admiral Kimmel specifically requested that Washington let him know immediately about any important developments. Did they ever respond to him?
They told him, yes, we will give you the information, but they didn't, because they did not want him to interfere with this Japanese overt act of war. And on November 27th, 1941, Admiral Kimmel and General Short were both told, don't interfere with the Japanese overt act. Just stand aside, keep your defenses, but don't go on the offensive. And that's what they did from November 27th on. While they suspected this was going to happen, they were told not to interfere with the overt act of war.
In fact, you're right, Admiral Kimmel was so concerned about the possibility of a Japanese attack that he sent nearly 100 warships out in the Pacific to intercept the Japanese. That was on November 23rd.
Yes, that's right. He recalled the Pacific Fleet, that was some of the warships were on the Pacific coast for overhaul and recreation, and recalled them all. About 200 of them involved, and when they went up to the North Pacific, this is north of Honolulu, Pearl Harbor, and we're in the exact location where the Japanese planned to launch the attack about 10 days hence. That was on November 23rd, 1941.
So again, he was told to bring his ships back to ensure that any encounter, presumably to ensure that any encounter did not occur in the high seas, where it could be said to have been perhaps an accident, but to make it clear that the attack would occur where it was unambiguously aggression.
That's right. They did not want it to look like the United States was provoking Japan. They wanted a clear-cut, overt act of war that would be so outrageous that it would unify the American public and end the isolation movement. And that's really what happened. And Admiral Kimmel was the and General Short were the scapegoats on this. Admiral Kimmel did get some information. He was definitely told after not to interfere with the Japanese attack.
In fact, the U.S. Navy declared the Northern Pacific what we call a vacant sea.
Yes, there are all of the United States and Allied warships and merchant vessels were excluded from the North Pacific, including air reconnaissance. It was all called off. And there were two Russian ships that were en route from San Francisco to Kamchatka, Alaska, that would have crossed the Japanese invasion force, but they were held at Astoria, Oregon, until after the attack.
Now, there was a last-minute warning that has actually came out through an intercept from the Japanese Foreign Office, a message sent to the Japanese ambassador in Washington just a few hours before the attack. Could you talk about that intercept and what happened to that message?
Yes, the morning of December 7th, 1941, the Japanese diplomatic missions revealed that at 1 o'clock Washington time, they were going to sever relations with the United States. Well, 1 o'clock Washington time is early morning in Honolulu, and they realized that was the time most likely of the attack. But that information was withheld also from Admiral Kimmel and General Short until after the attack. General Marshall, who was the chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the admiral in charge of the U.S. Navy in Washington, both said it by Western Union, the slowest possible information to Kimmel and Short, so they did not arrive there in Honolulu until well after the attack.
So the bottom line was that the attack did occur as the Japanese planned it, and what was the result to our U.S. Navy installation?
Well, the Japanese attacked our battleships and other warships there at the Pearl Harbor. But these were the only ones left there, you see, were the old World War One relics. All our modern ships were out of the harbor. Our carriers and their escorts were going to deliver some planes to Midway and Wake Islands. But
is it possible that they were sent out so that we would have a major attack but not lose our most important assets?
Well, yes. So our most modern ships were out. I think that was done deliberately so that they would not be placed in harm's way the way the old battleships were. We could lose those old battleships. They could not keep up with carriers.
And how many sailors died?
There was around 3,000 killed at Army and Navy and civilians at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941.
Now, General Short and Admiral Kimmel took the blame for the attack, but under the Clinton administration, they were somewhat exonerated. Could you talk about that?
Yes, in Congress really absolved Admiral Kimmel and General Short of any responsibility of that in October 2000. And it was a close vote, but the majority won. But the remedy was that the president of the United States would restore the ranks to Admiral Kimmel and General Short. But neither Clinton or President Bush have done that.
Now, I'm sure listeners are wondering how congressional investigations never discovered these very important facts about the Pearl Harbor attack, but that you, an independent researcher, were able to find these documents and these other facts. Could you talk about how you acquired the information?
Well, yes. You see, there was suspicion that the Roosevelt administration had intercepted this type of these kind of messages that we've been discussing. But that was all withheld from the major congressional investigation of 1945 and 46. None of these intercepts that were gathered by the 25 monitor stations were even disclosed to Congress. And they were all locked up in naval vaults in Crane, Indiana. Well, I learned about that in the late 1980s and filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Navy to see these documents. And to the credit of the Navy, they did, at first they were reluctant to do it, but by January 1995, they released the great bulk of this, and this is where I learned about the McCullum memo.
And what has their attitude been since? Has the government conceded the accuracy of your findings, or has the government pulled back and now not cooperated?
Well, there's no doubt that these are all official records and they're all accurate. But after my book was published, the Navy started withdrawing many of these documents. There's over at least 1,000 withdrawal notices involving thousands of pages of these intercepts prior to Pearl Harbor, you know, prior to December 7th, that have been withdrawn.
What more would you like to see done in order to have the truth about Pearl Harbor fully revealed?
Well, the U.S. Navy has got to release all of these informations, all the information that's been withdrawn. Though we have the bulk of the information that we've been discussing here on this broadcast, and also the National Archives do have the records there. So all of your listeners, if we want to, can go to Washington and see the records themselves.
Well, thanks very much for being with us, Mr. Stinnett. This is Ken McDermott Rowe, and I've been talking with Robert Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. I'll be back in a moment with some final thoughts. World War II is not the only example of a war that the American people have been induced to support through misrepresentation. Consider in more recent history the bloody Vietnam War, begun on the false claim of Vietnamese aggression in the Gulf of Tonkin, or the Iraq War, begun on the threat of non-existent weapons of mass destruction. The use of distorted intelligence and outright lies by leaders bent on war is not unique to America. In 1939, the Nazi regime dressed German soldiers as Poles and conducted attacks on German soil to justify the invasion of Poland. In the stampede to war, leaders may attempt to terrify the people. They may accuse those who question their facts and motives as unpatriotic. They may tell citizens that they don't have the right to know because it would, quote, endanger national security. But in considering the case for war, citizens must consider the lessons of history. And history teaches us that when it comes to war making, everything the leaders tell the people isn't necessarily true. Please visit us at historycounts.org. where you can listen for free to an archive of this program and others. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.